Mom and Dad Are Fighting is brought to you by BullandBranch.com, offering luxury bedding at affordable prices. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BullandBranch.com. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com and use the promo code MOMANDDAD. And by Little Passports. Inspire your kids to learn about the world with a subscription to Little Passports. Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners can save 40% on their first month today with the promo code MOMANDDAD. Learn more at littlepassports.com/momanddad. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/momanddad and using the promo code MOMANDDAD.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, May 12th, the Is Grit Good edition. I'm Allison Benedict, an editor at Slate and the mom of Harry, 7, Sam, 5, and Wally, 3.
I'm Dan Kois. I'm also an editor at Slate, and I'm the dad of Lyra, who is 11, and Harper, who is 8.
Hey, Dan.
Hello.
On today's show, we will talk to Slate columnist Dan Engber about the new book, Grit, and assess its author, Angela Duckworth's ideas on what makes successful humans. Then we'll talk to the authors of a new book, The Game Theorist's Guide to Parenting. Also, parenting triumphs and fails, a listener call about online message boards, and a very special Slate Plus segment featuring Dan's family. But first, announcements.
If you like our show, like us on Facebook. We are at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. And the more likes we get, the more likely it is that Slate will continue paying us for our show. More importantly, the Facebook page is a great way to see recommendations, to suggest show topics, to participate in great parenting conversations. For example, right now, if you go to the page, we have a ton of amazing vegan and vegetarian recipes up on the page now, thanks to listeners. I don't know if you've looked at that, Allison, but they are, like, great.
Yep.
Also, the page is full of people telling Allison that the Jews didn't really build the pyramids. unlike what she claimed on our last episode. Anyways, it's really fun. Also, who knows where these conversations will go for listener Megan McBride. The Mom and Dad Are Fighting Facebook page ended with her getting a great essay published on Slate. The essay is called Let's Get Lost. It ran last week, and it started as a comment on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. A second announcement, thanks to everyone who wrote in wanting to be our podcast interns. We are so excited that so many of you are excited to work with us. We are reading through all those emails now, and I promise that everyone who wrote in will get an email back letting you know what up. Triumphs and fails. Allison.
Okay, so I think I think this is a fail. I think I did something really weird, but you can tell me. So John and I are thinking of hiring a 19-year-old young woman to watch our kids this summer. She's home from her freshman year of college, and she seems great and fun and responsible, and her references are glowing. But John is, like, a little nervous about having someone so young watch the kids full time. So he wanted me to call her mom. And I felt strange about doing this. And I talked to our colleague, Jessica Winter, actually about it. And she astutely said that we chide millennials for being over-reliant on their parents and, like, write style section articles making fun of them for bringing their parents on job interviews. And yet now I'm calling this girl's mommy to, I don't know, what exactly? Make sure it's okay with her if her daughter, who is an adult, albeit a young one, takes this job, or ask her if she thinks her daughter can handle it. But I did it. And I called. I left a totally weird voicemail message. And I'm still waiting to hear back from her. And I'm just wondering if this mom is going to be like, dear to her daughter, you do not want to work for this lady. What do you think?
I don't think she will probably do that. But I also don't think it was necessary to call her. I agree with Jessica on this. Like, you shouldn't have had to do that. It doesn't really make that much sense. And also, you're not going to get, like, good information out of it. You're like, what? She's not going to call you back and be like, actually, she's on crack.
Right. She's not going to sell out her daughter. I'm not expecting that. I guess I don't really know exactly what John was hoping to get from this, other than maybe some reassurance that, like, mom is also, like, a rock and in case anything would go bad. I don't know what. I don't know.
The mom would show up at your house and take care of your kids.
I don't
kids.
Know. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
Anyway. I'll call that also a fail on John's part, because he should have made this stupid idea happen on his own.
Or called her. Yeah, exactly. If right. If he wanted to happen. Right. Yes, that's what he meant. Okay. Right. What do you have?
I have a triumph. It's a very, very simple triumph, which is that Lyra had her 11th birthday, and we not only figured out the perfect present for her, we figured that perfect present out 10 months ago, which is when we had to buy that present. Her present was not Ace of Hates, America's favorite family card game, available now at aceofhates.com. She already has that. Her present was tickets to Hamilton. Yep. We bought them last summer when you could still buy them for regular old face value. Because I just knew, like, I knew that when the cast album came out, we would buy it and she would go insane about it and she would love it and she would want to see the show so bad and it would be impossible to get tickets then. So we bought tickets before the show even opened on Broadway for April 2016. And we unveiled it with, we like sang a little song that Alia wrote to the tune of Wait For It. And Lyra was both totally mortified and unbelievably excited. And she
Are you taking both girls?
Really happy. Well, here's the fail. The fail is that Harper immediately started crying out of jealousy and rage.
Yeah.
As soon as she found this out.
Yeah.
And we had to be like, Harper, you also have a birthday. But it didn't work that well. So she's still very upset.
Wait,
eventually
meaning,
she'll be so happy.
Meaning you
Meaning that on her birthday in August, she is also getting tickets to Hamilton. For not from us, from her grandmother, but she will also be going to Hamilton, but for her birthday.
Okay. Great job. Great
Thank
job.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Especially great job, like, keeping it that whole time, because I imagine all along they've been asking you if they can go to Hamilton. You've
yes,
been like, no,
I
no,
mean,
no.
It made it a lot easier to keep it, actually, that there was, like, it made it easier to answer that question that we knew that the answer eventually would be yes, and it made us feel better about being like, who knows? It's really expensive. It's so hard to get tickets. Like, it made it into more of a game.
Listeners, if you, like me, have never listened to even a one single song from Hamilton, email me so I don't feel so alone.
You're the no one's gonna email you, Allison. You're the only one.
Okay,
moving on.
Mom and Dad Are Fighting is sponsored by Bull and Branch. Love sleep and dream of sleep and know you would be a much better parent with more sleep. Maybe having nice sheets will help you get more of it. And the sheets from bullandbranch.com are really, really soft and lovely to get into bed with. With Boll & Branch sheets, you know you're paying for quality sheets, not department store overhead. Boll & Branch sheets are extremely soft, durable, and a set costs only a few hundred dollars. They also sell really cute crib sheets and baby blankets and scarves and hats. So go to bullandbranch.com now to try their sheets for 30 nights risk-free. If you don't love them, send them back. Also, listeners, you can get 20% off your entire order plus free shipping. Just go to bullandbranch.com today for 20% off. Use the promo code MOMANDDAD. That's BOLLANDBRANCH.com, promo code MOMANDDAD. Okay, back to the show. What traits predict a person's future success, and how can we as parents help instill those traits in our kids? Psychologist Angela Duckworth thinks she's found the answer, and it is grit. In her new bestseller called, simply, Grit, Duckworth argues that grit, which she defines as a mix of perseverance and passion, is one of the most important predictors of success, and that we can all grow our grit and grow our kids' grit. Duckworth writes that she wants to use psychological science to help kids achieve and thrive. You can expect to hear a lot about this idea in the coming months, but Slate columnist Dan Angbar is skeptical of what he calls the Church of Grit and wrote a big piece for Slate saying so earlier this week, and he's here to tell us why he's not aboard the grit train. Hey, Dan.
Hey.
Okay, so before we get started, I was hoping we could all take the grit test that Duckworth devised to see where we rank. Is everyone cool with that?
I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and listeners, you should take this along with us, and we'll post on our Facebook page how to score it. Okay, so question one, are you guys ready?
Ready.
New ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones.
Very much like me.
Very much like me.
Very much like me. Setbacks don't discourage me.
Somewhat like me.
No, not very much like me.
Not much like me, also.
You know what I'm going to say? I'm going to change mine. I'm going to change mine to mostly like me. Mostly like me.
I have been obsessed with a certain idea or project for a short time, but later lost interest.
Definition of me.
very much like me.
Very, very, very much like me.
I am a hard worker. I'm going to go with somewhat like me.
Oh, Allison. Mostly like me.
Mostly like me, I think.
I often set a goal, but later choose to pursue a different one.
Not much like me.
That sort of contradicts an earlier answer that you gave, but that's fine. I'm going to say somewhat like me.
Somewhat like me.
I have difficulty maintaining my focus on projects that take more than a few months to complete.
I'm bored of this test. Can we do something else?
Very much like me.
Very much like me.
Not much like me.
I'm getting the sense that Dan Coyce is grittier than we are. I finish whatever I begin. Not like me at all.
Somewhat like me.
Somewhat like me. Somewhat.
I am diligent.
Very much like me.
Somewhat like me.
Somewhat like me.
I think you guys are undervaluing yourselves. You could not be good at what you did if you weren't diligent.
Well,
Benedict, come on.
We know what the right answers to these questions are. So this is
right,
sort of
why
like
you give the right
self-esteem
answer.
Test as much right. as a grit test.
My self-esteem is great. My grit esteem. All right. So Anne is going to grade this for us while we discuss with you. And then she's going to reveal how much less gritty than me you guys are at the end of our segment.
Okay, Dan.
Yes.
In your piece, you seem pretty troubled about how this idea of grit has so embedded itself into our culture in the past few years. You list off a bunch of books by other people who are basically making the Duckworth argument. But besides that, besides the proliferation of best-selling books, how has this idea of grit infiltrated our lives and our kids' lives?
Aside from the books, well, I mean, it's in our schools. It's in the New York Times had a story about grit testing in California public schools. So this is a formal part of the curriculum. Not only are the students being graded on their grit, but teachers and the schools themselves are being graded on the grit. And I mean, I should say that Angela Duckworth herself thinks that's a bad idea. But it just goes to show that, you know, this idea of grit and character building more broadly is, I think, ubiquitous in sort of educational circles right now.
You talk in the piece about how grit, as defined by Duckworth, is actually not a new idea and that it's kind of a branch of a trait that it sounds like you consider legitimately important or an important factor in determining success, which is conscientiousness.
Yeah. So grit is, you know, one way to think about it is that it overlaps in a lot of ways with measure called conscientiousness. It also could be considered what they call in personality psychology a facet of conscientiousness. So conscientiousness is one of the big five personality traits. And these were devised to kind of, you know, collect up all of these individual personality traits that psychologists had come up with over the years.
What are the five?
The five are agreeableness, openness, conscientiousness, and something else.
One was like neuroticism, right?
Neuroticism.
Is that important? Is that considered important? I'm asking for a friend.
For doing well in school?
For success, yeah. These are like predictors of success, right?
I don't know.
Okay.
In terms of predicting success, and again, success in a lot of these studies is quantified by how well you do in school. Conscientiousness of all the big five personality traits seems to be the most important one. And it makes sense because it includes things like willpower, industriousness. Again, these are sometimes called facets of conscientiousness, grit, and other things about how, you know, responsible you are, how punctual you are. That's a big deal in how well you do in school. Do you get to class on time? Do you do your homework? So all of those kinds of qualities a person might have tend to be, you know, encompassed by their conscientiousness.
So it seems like the point of sort of the first half of your piece is that grit as a marker is essentially something that Angela Duckworth in her research made up that is not that different from other things that we measure, but is actually less quantifiably successful in fostering good grades or whatever than this thing that we already know about.
Well, Angela Duckworth, I mean, she invented grit and the grit scale, but she acknowledges that that grit is, you know, very much like and perhaps identical to other things that researchers have talked about in the past, like willpower or, you know, you could go all the way back and talk about like the superego and what used to be measured by psychologists as something called superego strength. So I don't think she's saying, look, I've invented something totally new. But the claim that she makes in the book is that grit or willpower or industriousness or whatever you call it is She says it's as important as intelligence, or maybe more so, and that it, and therefore, it is the thing that we should be focusing on, because we don't really want to think about things like cognitive ability. So that's the message of the book, and then I think that's sort of two points that fit together.
Right, and the further message of the book is that grit can be taught, and here's how to do it. And that's what you really seem to be pushing against in this piece, is this notion that there, that we have any understanding of how you can actually teach such a quality.
Yeah, I mean, even taking a step back, I would push back against the sort of insane premise of the book, which she spends a couple of chapters on at the beginning, which is this idea that Americans don't already value grit, that we somehow we overvalue the importance of native intellect, and we undervalue the importance of getting someplace through hard work. I mean, it's just, it's crazy that's where she begins as a surprising idea. Does that strike you as weird as it strikes me?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of the, like, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and self-made man, that's like as American as it comes.
Right. So, I mean, I have this sort of big question about the book, which is, what's the point? What's missing now from our understanding of how kids succeed, if the cure is to remind us that kids better learn to work hard? It's so strange.
But I think that does resonate with parents, though. Like, it certainly resonated with me when I first heard about it. And I heard about it from my sister-in-law, who is an educator and who has really, like, signed on in a big way to Angela Duckworth and this notion of grit as something that she really sees the kids in her classes and the kids that she deals with missing. And I think parents feel that too, that, like, I know I feel it about my kids, that they have, like, no stick-to-itiveness, and they are not persistent, and they are not the sort of bold in the face of any kind of minor failure.
You feel that more than, like, the generation, like, than we were? Like, you think that's gotten...
I don't know. I certainly feel like, I mean, certainly the stereotype about parents of this generation, and one that I see all the time and I try not to fall into, right, is that we're helicopter parents who always, like, swoop in and solve our kids' problems for them. And so I think we have a natural inclination or concern that as a result of that, our kids are not ever able to deal with any kind of stumbling block in the road. And that seems like the definition of grit to me.
Well, I mean, in a way, to the extent that grit is I find the concept interesting. It's in the idea that maybe this is a quality that some kids have, maybe your kids don't.
Sorry, Dan.
I'm just going by what the guy is telling me. That it's actually a really fundamental personality trait, and that there's nothing you can do about it. Like, that's the interesting point, that it is kind of like intelligence. Although, I mean, there's a side thing. Maybe you can improve someone's, tested cognitive ability through some kinds of interventions. But anyway, the idea that, I might be a smart person, but I'm not very gritty. Oh, well, that's just who I am. Like, that's kind of interesting. And I think that's probably the case.
So that's what you believe the science supports, as opposed to Angela Duckworth's idea that you're a smart person, you're not that gritty, but through a sustained set of tasks and trainings, we can make you more gritty and make you a bigger success than you would be otherwise. Like, you'd write for a better magazine than Slate, for example.
Well, I think there's this bias to think that, we're all kind of afraid of intelligence, talking about intelligence, thinking about intelligence. It's a problematic concept, sure. But I think there's this bias to think, oh, well, that's just something you're born with, which is part of why it's so scary to talk about, because you get into all these, difficult areas of, what if this person was born smarter than I am? But we're just, do we not think the same thing of personality? My nieces are twins. They had their fraternal twins. They had different personalities in the womb, as far as I know, in terms of who was kicking and pushing. They had different personalities in, freshly born. That's the weirdest phrase I've ever used. They had different personalities right
fresh
after they
out
were,
of the oven.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. They had different personalities right after they were born. They have different personalities today. I mean, I think, again, that's something that people intuit, that personalities are pretty hardwired. And yet, I think there is, running through the Angela Duckworth book and through the cult of grit, is this idea that, oh, because it's not intelligence, this is something where we can really intervene and help, kids and who are struggling in school. It just kind of makes us feel better, because for some reason, oh, well, grit is fixable. Intelligence probably isn't.
The other thing that bothers me about this idea, and Judith Shulevitz in her review of the book argued pretty persuasively, that the emphasis on grit as a path toward winning, I don't know if, if you're going to feel sympathetic to this at all, Dan, but might be just like sending our kids the wrong message. She wrote that a focus on grit decouples character education from moral development, and Duckworth never questions the values of a society geared toward winning, nor does she address the systemic barriers to success. Does that bother you?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. She talks about her purposeful top-level goal. So her background is as a McKinsey consultant. I think in a lot of ways the book is structured as a McKinsey presentation, and it's very effective for that reason. So she talks about her purposeful top-level goal, which is to, as you quoted, to use psychological science to help kids achieve and thrive. Actually, that's the way she phrases it the first time in the book. Every other time she mentions it, she takes out achieve. And I just kept paying attention to that because the achieve part of that first construction kind of gave me the heebie-jeebies. Yeah. Like, what does achievement mean? Well, in her study, she looks at, you know, winning the spelling bee or placing in a final round in the spelling bee or getting good grades. And in other kinds of studies, it's like how much money you make. I mean, this is one idea of what achieve. I relate to that. Like, if you're going to do this kind of research, how else are you going to quantify the outcome? Like, grades is a pretty good way. It's good to get good grades in terms of, I'm sure, how happy you are in the rest of your life or how much you have to struggle in the rest of your life. But it's still kind of awkward.
I don't know, guys. I still feel like most parents are going to read this and are going to understand that should grit exist as a measurable thing, or even if it is simply a slightly less measurable character trait that we all kind of recognize but can't be quantified as easily as Angela Duckworth claims it can be, it's clearly something that people can relate to that can make your life better, that persistence in the things that are important to you and an unwillingness to be deterred by like minor setbacks is like useful.
Yeah, but there are major setbacks. Like, don't you think that it can possibly be kind of dangerous? Like, in a school with a lot of underprivileged kids who are just told to, you know, work harder, that it's not about the resources or about their life experience. I mean, if it is boiled down to this one thing, and not, I don't think that she's arguing that it should be boiled down to this one thing, but that seems like not great to me.
I mean, so there's two twin studies that were done on grit, and they both found that grit is heritable. So, you know, identical twins are going to be more similar in their level of grittiness than fraternal twins, even if they're raised in separate places. But they also found that the influence of shared environment, so that's going to cover, you know, how their parents treated them, what kind of school they went to, had zero influence on differences in grit among the twin pairs. So, I mean, you're right. It's intuitive that grit is important, and I think the studies bear that out. It does have an influence on what kind of grades you get, for example. But it's so unclear whether there's really anything that can be done about it.
All right. So I want to step back a little from this very focused discussion and talk about the Duckworth phenomenon more broadly. Dan, you've written a lot in many different circumstances about the sort of popularization of social science and scientific research in different ways, and the way that then writers take these ideas and package them perfectly for the marketplace so that they can become the next Malcolm Gladwell or the next Jonah Lehrer or the next Angela Duckworth. And she has more of a scientific background than maybe some of these other writers do, but they're all sort of doing the same thing. And it's been interesting watching Angela Duckworth take this idea, as you say in your piece, package it perfectly. In fact, come up with one name for it that wasn't quite as appealing and then hit upon the perfect word for it, grit, which is like so sticky and immediately appealing to a person like me. And then sort of transform this into a little cottage industry, into a genius grant, into a long and profitable, presumably speaking career, and now into this book, which is probably going to be a gigantic hit and influence people everywhere. As someone who observes this sort of phenomenon happening over and over again, it's a phenomenon that parents in particular see in action all the time because we're constantly trying to figure out what the hell we should be doing about our kids, and we look to experts to tell us those things. If you have an Angela Duckworth who has like a kind of sticky, interesting idea at the beginning of her career and has the chance to research it out, what alternate path would you want that person to take to like make that idea to rigorously investigate that idea as opposed to like sort of immediately going the packaging and presentation route.
What do I think Angela Duckworth should do or should have done?
Should have done, or anyone who has sort of this kind of idea that you can immediately hear like the cash register bells chiming in your head when you think of it.
Well, I mean, in the book, there's this one part where she talks about what's that she gets asked. She's kind of this guru now. So she goes around giving talks to people, to parents and educators. And she's often asked, like, what's the best way to make my kid as gritty as possible? And in the book, she says, you know, there really isn't, we don't have any research to tell us the best way to do it. So I could just not say anything at all. But I'm a mom. I have two kids and I want to just give the best answer possible. So I'm going to just tell you a whole bunch of stuff based on my best impressions as a psychologist. And take them for what they are. Now, do I think that she shouldn't dispense that advice? I mean, kind of, yeah. This is ending up in federal education policy. I don't really blame Angela Duckworth. I blame the people who are responsible for looking at the best research on how to intervene to make children's lives better and then to implement policies. I think those are the people who are at fault for just, you know, watching a TED talk and then writing up a policy document. That's where the problem is.
All right. Daniel and Allison, are you ready to hear how gritty we actually are?
Yes. And give us our scores.
Okay. So, grit. Here's your score. Dan E., you got 2.375.
Wow. That's even lower than when I did the grit test on myself before. I'm going in the wrong direction.
Allison, you got 2.25. Mm-hmm. And
so even less gritty than Angmer.
Yeah. And then Dan K., you got 2.875.
Oh, I'm shocked. I thought Dan was going to inflate his own grittiness to a 4.
Okay. We're all very low grit. So it's not, we're all in the like the bottom sixth of the U.S. adult population. But I bet that a lot of journalists are.
We're just more honest than most of the adult population. All right. So the book is called Grit. The article on Slate is called Is Grit Really the Key to Success? It's by Dan Angmer. We'll post a link on our show page. And we want to hear, you know, we want you guys to take the test. Are you grittier than us? We're apparently not gritty, although I'm still slightly more gritty than you two. But also we want to know, like, is this an idea that you feel has value, even though there's clearly not a real scientific basis for it. I think many people are going to feel that way. I kind of sneakily feel that way anyway. But I also recognize that Angela Duckworth is like creating something not exactly out of whole cloth, but something that exactly suits the needs of the pop sociology guru. All right. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks for having me on.
Inspire your kids to learn about the world with Little Passports. This award-winning educational subscription sends you monthly packages in the mail, each featuring a new country or world theme. Packages are addressed to your child and are filled with letters, souvenirs, stickers, activities, and more. It's a great way for kids to learn about geography and cultures around the globe. And also food. A recent package we got from Little Passports, which included a memory game with cards of foods from around the world, actually inspired us to take our kids out for dim sum for the first time. And they hated it. But Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners can save 40% on their first month of Little Passports today with the code MOMANDDAD. Learn more and take a peek inside the monthly packages at littlepassports.com/momanddad. Okay, on to our listener call.
All right, for our listener question, as listeners know, every week we answer a question from a listener. If you've got a question you want us to answer, give us a call at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE. Today's question comes from some guy. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Dan. I live in Virginia. I have a question for Mom and Dad Are Fighting. Love the show. My daughter, who just turned 11, let's call her Myra. She is not on social media in like the traditional sense, but she does use this app, this coding app for school called Hopscotch, and it has within it like a message board, an old school message board type system. And I think it was originally meant to be like, you know, kids asking kids questions about coding. But in the tradition of message boards everywhere, it has sort of expanded to cover like everything that kids are thinking about, with some measure of drama, the way kids often are. So she has been talking a lot to us about how important her message board friends are to her and getting upset when we tell her that her screen time's over because, you know, like, I have a friend who's about to quit hopscotch and we have to talk her out of it. Anyway, we looked at her posts on the message board and she's definitely like putting herself out there. I mean, it's not like she's like saying her name and address or whatever, but like her opinions on hot button issues, you know, for example, like parsing the difference between gay and straight and bi and trans and talking about her fears and her insecurities and friend drama, like real life friend drama. So in general, like stuff that feels pretty intense for a just turned 11-year-old. And we're not like worried about security or anything like that, as far as I can tell. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it seems like the boards are moderated by adults and it's a school sanctioned product and pretty much everyone on it seems to be a kid, but we're like just a little worried about her getting so emotionally attached to these message boards that she, you know, is like attached to these message board randos who are definitely gonna, you know, fade away eventually as all people on message boards do and who are not necessarily real friends who have her best interests at heart. So we sat down with her. Here's the question. We sat down very non-confrontationally and we talked to her about it. We said that we hoped that she would feel comfortable asking us some of the questions that she's asking the people on these message boards and talking to us about the stuff that is in her heart that she's worried about. We said that we really think that she is a little bit young to be putting like her heart and soul on the internet, that it may be when she's older, that online communities become really important to her, but we want her to use the hopscotch boards right now for what they're really intended for, to talk about the app, to talk about coding tricks. And she agreed, and is sort of complying, like her posts are less personal, but still with some like drama attached. And I'm sure she will like sort of head back in that direction because that's like the natural way of things. So anyways, should we have, done it this way? Did we handle it right? Is this a triumph or a fail or somewhere in between? Should we?
Oh my God, never in the history of listener calls has anyone called in and been so long-winded that it's been cut off.
That guy seems really tortured about this question.
Finish it off,
he
Dan.
He sounds handsome.
this is one we would have been now. Like, we would have sent to Anne and been like, Anne, can you edit this way down?
Right, yeah. No, I'm a lot more sympathetic now to people going on and on windily on our phone line. So here's the question. Should we have set down a harder line? Should we have just said, forget it, like you need to get off hopscotch for a while? Should we have like embraced this relatively safe online community as like sort of like training wheels social media, especially because we can read everything she does? What should we have done? Or did we handle it right? Or is there no right way to handle this? Allison, what do you think?
I'm honored that you're asking me. I'm curious what my co-host thinks, but
Joker, he doesn't know.
I don't really get what you're upset about. I mean, I didn't, you know, I haven't seen her posts, and you're not entirely fully explaining, nor do you need to, the nature of them. But I don't know. She's expressing herself online as long as it actually is a safe environment. She's expressing herself, her, you know, personal or political views. She's making connections, even if those aren't, you know, people who are going to last in her lives. I mean, something that the caller said about, like, these aren't real friends. They don't have her real best interest at heart. I'm not sure, like, necessarily the kids she hangs out with at school and maybe would tell this stuff to over lunch, you can assume have her best interest at heart either. Not that the world is a terrible place, but, like, I don't know that you can divide, like, people who you talk to in person want to help you. People that you talk to online want to hurt you. So, I think probably unless you sensed that this whole experience was kind of making her seem off or troubling her when she was not online, I don't really see what the problem is.
I think that's probably good advice for this caller. So I was interested in this. So I actually did a little reporting on this one for Dan and his daughter, Myra. I talked this afternoon to the CEO of Hopscotch, who's named Jocelyn Levitt. and asked her about like what the moderation is like on the site, because it, you know, the caller didn't seem clear on that question. He wasn't doing a particularly good job, it seemed like, paying attention to what his kids were doing online, honestly. And the moderation is pretty good on this particular site. Like, it's users flag posts, and then there are adult moderators who remove anything that has two flags and put adult eyes on it. There are also adults who are just sort of coasting through these message boards and reading stuff and making sure that things are happening. And more than that, and this is something that that I've seen on Hopscotch, there's a real ethos on the site toward like sort of steering people toward staying on topic, the topic being coding. And of course, people tend to talk about anything, but then they too tend to steer those conversations back to coding. And people are like nice about it. The site seems very supportive. People in general seem to have adopted this philosophy of helping people and not being mean to them. And like, it seems clear. And also, it really is like all kids. Like, there's like a couple of adults who are parents of kids who use Hopscotch who are also on asking questions. But generally, it's like all kids. So I think it is a pretty safe environment. And I think that you're probably right, Allison, that this is an environment in which young Myra can sort of flex these online interaction muscles that are probably going to be a big part of her life in the future in a relatively safe space. So I do think that the caller freaked out a little bit, perhaps because just the idea that these strangers were getting access to the inside of his kid's head, when it's harder for him to get access to his inside of his kid's head as she gets older, was something that was like a visceral jolt to him. But it's something he'd better get used to.
Yeah, I mean, I found it sweet that the caller asked Myra to, instead of talking to these people online, talk to him or to her mother. But come on.
Because she's not going to.
Yeah. Are you going to go back to Myra on your way to Bamilton and tell her that she can go back to being herself?
I mean, I think she basically is already headed that way, so I think we're just going to let it play out.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. If you, like caller Dan, have a question you really want experts like us to address, give us a call. Once again, 424-255-7833. Let's move on to our next topic. My kids fight, of course, all the time. They fight pretty much every day. Yesterday, they got in a huge screaming argument about the definition of a sharp turn. It ended with both of them in tears and like shouting at each other in the driveway. But more of their fighting is about normal stuff. Like, usually it's who gets a toy or whose shirt is this or who gets to go first. It can feel sometimes like I need the skills of a professional hostage negotiator to navigate these fights. Or do I need the skills of a game theorist? Kevin Zollman is a game theorist and a professor of philosophy at Carnegie Mellon. With journalist Paul Rayburn, he's the author of The Game Theorist's Guide to Parenting. Kevin and Paul, co-authors of this cool book, are here to teach us a little bit about how to deal with the toughest negotiators we will ever face, our children. Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
So to start off, maybe for those listeners who are not game theorists, what is game theory?
So the way we describe it is it's the science of strategic thinking. So the idea here is that, you know, any time that you're engaged in an interaction with somebody else where you care about what they do and they care about what you do, you're engaging in what we call a game. That is a strategic interaction where each of you matter to the other one. And game theory is a kind of mathematical theory that's designed to try and help you make decisions in those kind of problems. In the book, we try and take the mathematics away and just distill the kind of basic lessons that have been learned using this mathematical theory that could be applicable for parents.
So in essence, it's basically every interaction with your kids is important to each of you, potentially for different and competing reasons. And this helps you understand the various permutations that these interactions can have.
That's right. And it's also true that game theory applies in situations where the person you're negotiating with has a strategy that affects your strategy. For example, like a game of chess, you can plot out exactly how you want to move your pieces, but that is dependent at every move with what your opponent does. And that's the situation that game theory describes very well.
Does game theory require rational actors?
Well, that's an interesting question. Game theory you know, it's very complex mathematics, which I hasten to add, as Kevin said, is not in the book, but but it can get very hairy. And an interesting question is, why do we behave according to the rules of game theory? We weren't born and didn't grow up knowing all this mathematics, yet we follow it as if we did. And I think the answer to that is that game theory reflects something about human nature that developed over millions of years of evolution. For example, we talk a lot in the book about fairness and how kids have an intense interest in making sure that things are fair, that if they divide a box of Skittles, everybody gets the same number exactly. And the reason for that is that that, too, is part of our nature that goes back a long, long way. We know why that goes back, or we know it goes back at least as far as our ancestors, the ancestors we shared with monkeys, because monkeys also show an interest in fairness. In one great experiment that you can find on YouTube, an experimenter rewarded a monkey for various tasks with a piece of cucumber, and that was fine until he rewarded the monkey in the next cage with grapes, which is a real treat, and the next time he tried to give a cucumber to the monkey threw it back in his face. So even monkeys and small children are very interested in fairness, and game theory somehow reflects the way they behave.
I love that question, Allison, because you're clearly wondering whether your children could ever be rational actors.
Right. Yes, that's why I'm asking the question. Yeah. So with that in mind, explain the auction technique for solving this age-old problem of siblings not wanting to share.
That's Kevin's department.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So one of the things that's a real problem for parents is when you have some single good that both kids want, but you can't cut it in half or divide it, like who's going to name the family pet or who gets the larger bedroom. And so you have to try and figure out how can you give this to the children in a way that the kids will deem fair. And we recommend using auctions. So you have kids bid in order to get the thing that they want, whether that's the larger room or naming the family pet. And it might seem a little unfair or miserly to have them bid with money, so what we recommend instead is that they bid with chores or something that they both kind of dislike, but that you're, as a parent, happy to have them do. And so they might, you know, say, start the bidding with a very simple chore, like picking up one toy. And then another might bid, well, I'll pick up the whole room. And then another will say, well, I'll do the dishes for a week. And they can go back and forth, and then once they've settled on one of them's willing to do more chores in order to get the desired good, both kids are happy in a sense because one gets the larger room but also has to pay a cost. And the other one says, well, although I'd like the larger room, I definitely don't want to have to pay that big cost in order to get it. So that's a way to divide something between your kids that makes them both sort of neither one envy the other one. And that's a way to get at fairness between your children. And in the book, we talk about different ways that auctions can be run and different ways that you might try with your family to structure an auction amongst your kids.
So I both love that idea and also foresee an inevitable problem with then kids, my kids, not carrying out the promises that they made, which leads to my next question, which is about credible versus non-credible threats. So when I yell at my kids, you said you were going to do the dishes for a week, and if you don't, I'm going to whatever. I'm going to ground you, or I'm going to take away television for 4 days, or I'm going to remove you from screens. Now, of course, if I take away their television, I'm just screwing myself. if I don't let them on screens, I give up the all-important third parent in our home, the computer. And so it's really hard for me to follow through on those threats without making my own life harder. One of my favorite sections of the book talks about this dilemma. So what is the difference in game theory between a credible and a non-credible threat?
Well, here's we talk in the book about a situation called moral hazard. This comes out of economics, but it applies very well to families. And the idea of moral hazard is you put your kids in a situation that induces them to behave in a way that you don't want them to behave. So here's one of the examples we use. Suppose your daughter gets an allowance of $10 a week, and from that allowance, she's supposed to save something to buy popcorn when you go to the movies on the weekend. So it gets to be Thursday afternoon, Friday, and then Saturday, time to go to the movies. And it turns out, guess what? She spent her $10. Now, do you as the parent say, well, it's okay this week, I will buy the popcorn, but next week you save your money? Or do you say, I'm sorry, you spent your money that you were supposed to save, you'll have to budget better next week, no popcorn today? Well, that's a tough thing for a parent to do. You're out, you're going to the movies for fun, actually, and for everybody to end their week on a nice note. And the last thing you want to do is seem to punish your child on that trip outside. So the problem is, however, that if you go ahead and bail out your child, and of course, if I use the words bail out, suddenly this is something we know about. I think most of us feel, intuitively that it's a bad idea to bail kids out all the time. But in fact, if you bail out your kids, you know, when they've spent their allowance, you might find that you're bailing them out on a lot of other things. And this situation of moral hazard, you know, without being too grim about it, can lead to all kinds of things. If you bail them out of trouble they get into at school and bail them out of God knows, you know, involvement with alcohol or drugs when they're teenagers, you could have a very bad situation. So you want to be certain that when you make that kind of a deal with your kids, that you stick to it. And all that complicated mathematics that we keep talking about backs that up.
So, Kevin, I read in an interview you did with a Slate writer that you don't have kids. And I'm curious if writing this book change your perception of what parenting is like? Does it seem easier to conquer now that you're like, oh, well, you can just use game theory, or does it actually seem harder?
Oh, no, it seems harder. It definitely seems harder. Yeah, no, I mean, I do think the game theory is really helpful and certainly something that I would use. But, you know, I started talking to a lot of my friends. I have many friends who are both game theorists and parents, and so I started talking to them about this when I started writing the book, and I just sort of failed to appreciate before I thought about it how many really difficult situations parents are confronting. And I mean, game theory can help, but it's also not going to solve every parenting problem you ever face, I'm sorry to say. But and so as a result, I definitely am more afraid of the prospect of parenting than I was probably before I got the book.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Paul Rayburn and Kevin Zollman. The book is totally fun. It's called The Game Theorist's Guide to Parenting. We will have a link to buy it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Paul and Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, and best of luck with your kids.
Thank you. We need
thanks. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is also brought to you by Casper. Buying a mattress is a huge pain. You have to pick it out. You have to get it home, and then you sleep on it for like a week, and you're like, oh, I hate this. But what are you going to do? Bring it back? No. So what's the solution? The solution is Casper. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress made in America and sold at a shockingly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foam to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. It's so award-winning, in fact, that Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. If you order a Casper, you get to try it for 100 nights, risk-free, in your own home. You can sleep on it for like more than 3 months. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything you paid. You get free shipping. You get free returns to the U.S. and Canada. And if you are a listener of Mom and Dad Are Fighting, you get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/momanddad and using the promo code momanddad. That's once again, casper.com/momanddad, promo code MOMANDDAD. Terms and conditions, of course, apply. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Allison, what do you got?
Okay, so we just finished reading The Little Prince to the boys. I never read it as a child, as with most classic books. And man, is it beautiful and strange and sad and entrancing. I just loved it. And they loved it, which I was surprised about because it's so abstract. But I don't just want to recommend The Little Prince, which I feel like is a book that people probably have. I want to recommend spending a little extra money to get this sounds gimmicky, but it's not, to get the deluxe pop-up version, which came out last year and takes the already beautiful illustrations and uses paper engineering to create these really gorgeous little bursts of pop-up hands-on art on nearly every page that you can, you know, you spin things and move things. It makes the book really thick and extremely delicate, so store it in a safe place so that your children don't rip it to shreds. I'm shocked that my children haven't, but it's really worth spending the extra money on to get this edition.
That is a great recommendation. That book is beautiful. The pop-up version is beautiful. I'm going to add two recommendations on top of that. which is if your kids really love the story. There's also a really great comics version of it that a French cartoonist named Joan Safar did. He's a really, really great cartoonist that's also beautiful and interesting and complicates the story in a couple of interesting ways. And then also, if it's ever playing anywhere near you, there's a beautiful children's opera by Rachel Portman, who's also a film composer, about called The Little Prince, which is a great introduction to sort of simple opera for little kids. And my kids have seen it and loved it. And it's actually that was their first interaction with this story, and it got them really interested in the book.
That's so cool. Yay. Thank you for adding that.
Sure. My recommendation is so much less beautiful and so much more utilitarian than yours. It's Umbrellas from IKEA. So Allison, how many umbrellas would you say your family has lost in the last year?
492.
Okay, so that's a huge expense, right?
Yes.
And we were getting very frustrated by this as well. And I discovered that IKEA sells really good big umbrellas and fold-up ones if you want them, but also like big, well-constructed, sturdy, nicely designed umbrellas for $4.
Wow.
And they will send them to you for like a little bit of shipping. So you can like go onto the IKEA site and get the Kanala umbrella, K-N-A-L-L-A. And it comes in black and then also in some attractive patterns and designs. You can get like 20 of them for $80. Or
do they
you
have
can do
kids
what we did.
Size too?
They have like little foldable ones, which are perfectly appropriate for kids.
Yeah.
And I think those are maybe $5. But anyways, they're cheap and they're really well made. And you can just like buy a shitload of them like we did. And now if for the next 2 years, we probably won't run out of umbrellas. And when we inevitably do, we'll just order more from IKEA.
Okay. That is another great one. Better than our previous. Last week, the Haroset and egg in a toad in a hole.
Toad in a hole. Hey, yeah. We had listeners write to us about toad in a hole.
We did. That's true.
I made that. And plus, your recommendation inspired an important debate about who built the pyramids. All right.
Okay, that's our show. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Send us an email at momanddad@slate.com to suggest guests or topics or tell us what you think of grit or how you scored on the grit scale. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is part of the Panoply Network. Check out Panoply's full roster of shows at itunes.com/panoply. Thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman. Thanks to Steve Lichtai, the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers, head of Panoply. Thanks to our guests, Dan Engber, Paul Rayburn, and Kevin Zollman. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Allison.
And thank you all for listening.